The first case this morning is Newman versus Abbott Laboratories. Mr. McAllister.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Steve McAllister, and I represent the plaintiffs in this appeal. There are a lot of issues and a lot of facts thrown around in the briefs in this case, but I want to focus the court this morning on the three issues that the plaintiffs believe are crucial to the resolution of this case. The first issue is whether employers may act and rely upon a negative stereotype that employees who are receiving pension benefits are less motivated and less productive. Here, the district court made specific factual findings, paragraphs 137 through 140 in the supplemental or the short appendix, pages 58 to 60, that is precisely a motive that the defendants relied upon in this case. They believed that if employees retired from Abbott and went to work for Hospira, those employees would be unproductive and unmotivated. That is, of course, a stereotype and is one of the stereotypes that ERISA Section 510 prohibits an employer from acting upon. The defendants continue to rely upon that stereotype in their briefs in this court, and the district court, rather than finding that a violation of ERISA Section 510, credited it as a legitimate, permissible reason for taking the action the defendants did in the no-hire policy with respect to retirees. The second issue we'd like to focus on is the causation issue. ERISA talks about an employer acting for the purpose of interfering with a protected benefit. The district court wrongly concluded that meant but-for causation. All prior case law from this court prior to Gross, the Supreme Court decision discussed in the briefs, said it only has to be a factor, a motive, and the district court incorrectly thought Gross controlled ERISA Section 510. The third issue is the question of a breach of fiduciary duty, and actually the question is whether there is a duty. The district court said as a matter of law there's no duty, so it did not get into the question of whether the duty was breached by Abbott. All three of those are legal error to some extent in our view, and this court should reverse and remand for further findings. Now, on the first issue, the anti-pension recipient bias, the motives are clear. We're not arguing about the facts here. We're accepting the district court's findings of fact that the defendants acted with such a motive. There's plenty of evidence, plenty of testimony that was a motive the defendants relied upon, coming from the future CEO of Hospira, Begley, as well as the advisors at Hewitt, Arbaugh, and Moreland, that workers who were receiving a pension would not be as motivated, would not be as productive, would not be good workers. The district court relied specifically on that early in its opinion, but also in the conclusions of law, paragraph 6, specifically finding that was a legitimate reason for refusing to hire those employees. But that's a negative stereotype, just like age would be a negative stereotype, just like gender or race would be stereotypes that are not permissible under the law. And ERISA Section 510 does not permit the defendants to rely on this stereotype.
Well, not all stereotypes are necessarily inaccurate, are they?
Well, I guess it depends on what one means by a stereotype. If you define it as a generalization that is not based necessarily in fact or scientific fact, then stereotypes are at least in part inaccurate. If you mean that generalizations sometimes are persuasive or largely true, then perhaps not. But the problem with this stereotype is it's a stereotype that ERISA says employers cannot rely on.
Where does ERISA say that?
I'm sorry.
Well, in Section 510, it says you cannot interfere for the purpose of preventing someone from achieving or attaining a pension benefit. And that's one of the issues the defendants raise. They say, oh, well, this is just a hiring issue. ERISA doesn't cover that. But that's not true in this context. Because of this transaction, you had a company spinning off another company, and so Abbott effectively had control of the whole situation. It's more like the case of the employer who had the negative covenant that said you can't go work for someone else if you retire. That's what Abbott was trying to do here. They could not have said under ERISA, if you retire, you can't go work for someone else. There's no way they could have had such a policy. And yet that's effectively what they tried to do in their agreement with Hospira as part of the spinoff, is say, you retire, you can't continue working.
They were just trying to prevent double dipping. Well, ERISA doesn't prohibit that.
Except it's not double dipping in any legally prohibited sense, and the defendant's reliance on the same desk rule doesn't work here, for example. That's one of the arguments they make as to why this was justified. But anyone who retired from Abbott pre-spin, their funds, their payments all remained with Abbott. And, in fact, that's what CEO Begley was going to do himself. That's
right,
what he wanted to
and
do.
And nobody was prevented from doing that, right?
They weren't prevented from retiring, but they were punished in a sense. If they retired, they would not be allowed to continue with Hospira. So
well,
they could
that's
have.
Not, that's not punishment for the exercise of an ERISA right.
Well, the ERISA right would be to draw your pension benefits when you're eligible.
And nobody was prevented from doing that. They were just prevented from double dipping, which ERISA doesn't protect.
They were prevented from, I guess, but the way we'd view it, Your Honor, is they were discriminated against in the sense of if they exercised their right, they could not be hired. If they didn't exercise their right, they would be hired. And, of course, this goes to the also to the fiduciary duty part, and they would not only be hired, but they would be hired and
well,
then
they had no right to be hired by the new company, so there's no discrimination going on here.
Except that, again, Your Honor, the discrimination is against those employees who were eligible to retire and were told, if you do, you cannot work for us. And because of the situation where it was the spin and the companies are related, Abbott was in a position to control that in a way that it could not have controlled any employee who wanted to retire from Abbott and go work for someone else. So the discrimination is not... It's a different case, perhaps, or at least it's an unanswered question if an employer said, my policy is I don't hire anyone who's receiving a pension. Then we'll have to argue about that if that case ever arises. But that's not this case. This is an employer who had these employees, was creating a new entity, and was saying, we don't want you to retire from us if you want to go to the new entity. It's the sort of lack of any sort of independence. There's no arm's length. This is all being orchestrated by Abbott. That's why this is different than any typical, if it was just a rule, a no-hire rule. So they were targeting the employees who were considering retirement. And, again, it's all part of it ties into the scheme, I think, of the fiduciary duty problem.
Well, they were only targeting those employees who would attempt to retire from Abbott and be rehired by the spun company. And ERISA doesn't have anything to do with whether the spun company did or didn't have to hire the Abbott employees.
Well, maybe not with whether or not the spun company had to, but it does have to do with an employer, which in this case would include Abbott, trying to deter employees from exercising their ERISA-protected rights.
They weren't trying to deter anybody from retiring. Any of your clients could retire and get their full pension, or could have done so, right?
They could have done so, but...
But they just couldn't work for the new company at the same time and draw a full-time salary and a pension. That's double-dipping. And this was a perfectly legal attempt to prevent double-dipping.
Well, I think, but Your Honor, I guess I don't know about double dipping. Not a phrase that really came up in the case, but
that's what it is.
But the point is that they were trying to deter employees. They were trying to deter employees from retiring. They did not want them to retire for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is if they retired pre-spin, all of that liability and all that obligation remains at Abbott. If they move them to the new company, then they would begin to participate in a new company's plan, whatever that was going to be, and that goes to the fiduciary duty issue. They said frequently they did not want transition. They wanted people to continue. This was not, we're going to spin a new company. If you'd like to join us, please do. If you don't want to, please don't. It was much more, we want to move everybody. We want to get them over there, and we want to keep them from retiring on us. And so the way they did it was with the no-hire policy as applied to retirees. Then it really upped the ante for those people to even consider retirement because they've been told you could not be hired for 2 years at the new company. I don't think it's fair to say on the evidence that they didn't care whether people retired or not. They very much cared, and they very much did not want them to retire. And as the district court sort of viewed this, at least in the pretrial motions up through summary judgment, this is more of a scheme overall to try to get these people to transition to the new company where things would change, unknown to them, but things would change to the benefit of Abbott and to the benefit of Hospira, but potentially to the detriment of these employees, at least with respect to 510, we're talking about really count three, the subclass, the group that was eligible for retirement. And their detriment here was at least twofold. One, they did not have a chance to say to Abbott, well, if I'm going to the new company, can I get compensated for some of what I'm going to lose under the plans, like the five executives who knew what was going on and did seek and obtain a substantial portion of that compensation. And the second thing is they were making choices about retirement, I guess, without full knowledge of what was going to happen at the new company. And I'm sort of moving into the fiduciary duty question, but that's an important question because the district court took a very legalistic view that because the new company didn't exist until April 30th, there couldn't be any fiduciary duty regarding the new company's plan. But in fact, as far back as the fall, early fall of the year before, the executives knew what was going to happen. The chairman of the board to be of the new company knew what they wanted to do with pension and retiree medical benefits. The executives acted on that information and demanded that they get calculations for retiree medical, for pension losses. They wanted compensation for all of it. They were told by human resources, well, we can't compensate you for the pension loss because if we do it for you, we have to do it for everybody. But they did get compensated for the retiree medical. And the fact of the matter is it was really just a formality. After the new company became official and the board could meet to adopt those policies, the policies were set, and they were set effectively by Abbott people well before the date of the spin. So the district court simply wrong that there was no duty. And what we'd ask is that the court reverse on the duty question, and it would have to go back to because the district court did not make findings about all the facts that we believe clearly show a breach. So there would have to be findings made.
The terms of the Hospira benefit package were fixed before the spin by Abbott. Is that your position?
Effectively, yes.
What does that mean, effectively? I'm asking a factual question.
I mean, that's the formality. Of course, the new company can't have a vote of its board of directors until the board exists. So, of course, that action had to take place after the spin. But our argument throughout and the evidence shows strongly that the people involved in that decision-making process, and they were involved from the announcement of the spin in late August of 2003 through the spin at the end of April in 2004, they knew exactly what they were going to do and what was going to happen. And in our view, this is a lot like the Verity Corp case from the Supreme Court, where you have an employer who is, again, as I said earlier, trying to encourage these employees to move to the new company. Abbott does not want these employees to retire from Abbott and go away or work for someone else. It's trying to get them to move to the new company. And it's like Verity Corp in the sense of the employer is really talking about two plans, but not fully disclosing to the employees what's going to happen with one of the plans. So they're making a choice with a lot of...
Here there are actually three plans, though. There's that transitional plan.
Which was... In itself was misleading potentially in the sense of trying to say, oh, don't worry, we're going to maintain pension benefits through the end of the year, and the new company will decide after that. Well, the new company didn't need any time to decide. As soon as they could get the board together and ratify what they already knew they were going to do, they did. So the employees were told pretty quickly after the new company came into being that you're not going to have these benefits that you used to have under the Abbott plan. And that's why I think it's like Verity, because Verity, you had an employer saying, look, we have this other division. We'd like some of you to go over here. They're going to have this plan. It was omitting and misleading about what would happen. The employees went. It was a completely losing proposition, and those employees, the Supreme Court found, were the victims of a breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, there were active misrepresentations in that case, though.
But our position is there are active misrepresentations here in the
sense. But the district court found to the contrary, and you said you weren't contesting the findings of fact.
No, I said we weren't contesting the findings regarding their motive. Let me be clear. Their motive that they did not want retired workers coming over to Hospira. So we're not contesting paragraphs 137 to 140. But we are contesting the district court's conclusion that there was no fiduciary duty here, and very much so. That
well, that's a legal conclusion. I'm talking about the factual matter about misrepresentations. There were no misrepresentations here.
So you're right. I agree completely that whether there's a duty is a legal question, and that we think is absolutely, that's what Verity says. That's a question of law, so it's not a subject to clearly erroneous, as the defendant suggests. But on the breach question, because the district judge said, I find there's no duty whatsoever, he didn't make findings about whether there was a breach of the duty and doesn't talk about a lot of the evidence that we think shows that as far back as September and October of 2003, they were making these decisions. They knew what they were going to do with the new company's plan. And he doesn't really get into that because he just says sort of formalistically, there was no duty.
But as to the matter of misrepresentations, there are no factual findings that Abbott or its representatives made any misrepresentations with respect to the Hospira plan and what it would or wouldn't. There's no evidence of that, whether the district judge made findings about it or not. There's no evidence that they misrepresented what the Hospira plan would or wouldn't include. They just didn't say anything at all.
Well, I don't think that's completely true, Your Honor. They did, you know, they say we couldn't tell people what the plan was until we knew the whole plan. But in fact, they did use the transitional plan as a way to induce people to say, look, we'll continue everything through the end of 2004. But in our view, and then after that, the new company will decide.
Right.
But our view is that is a misrepresentation because they already knew when they said that what the new plan was going to do. So they're suggesting, at least implying to employees, oh, you may have the same benefits as you've had at Abbott. You will for at least the rest of the year, maybe beyond, we don't know. But, in fact, they knew that that wouldn't be the case. So that is. It's a misrepresentation, at least by omission, not telling them what you actually knew. And it's that kind of evidence. And there's, again, quite a bit of evidence, a number of exhibits and documents, emails and communications about the soon-to-be Hospira executives talking about what are we going to do with the new company. And it was very clear very early on they did not want an Abbott-type pension plan. They were not going to continue retiree medical. And so when the defendants say we couldn't tell them all aspects of the plan because we don't know, it would be bad to give people piecemeal information, well, they're sort of talking out of both sides of their mouth because they were giving employees information that was beneficial to Abbott, saying, oh, well, we'll continue the plan through the transitional plan through the end of the year. So they'd tell them that much, but they weren't going to tell them that after January 1, 2005, there won't be the same pension, there won't be retiree medical. So they were piecemealing the employees and if not affirmatively misrepresenting, at least doing so by omitting crucial and material information. And I think the information is material because the executives cared. So the five executives certainly thought this was material information. They demanded and got calculations of the lost retiree medical. They got calculations of the lost pension benefits. And as I said, the company paid them to the dollar the lost retiree medical. No other employees had the chance to seek that money. And the company said, we can't pay you for the pension, or perhaps it might have. I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal with the court's permission.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McAllister. Hurst.
May it please the court, Jim Hurst on behalf of Abbott Laboratories. Your Honors, there was a 10-day trial in this case. The district court saw 270 trial exhibits, heard from 19 witnesses, including Abbott's CEO, Miles White, Abbott's CFO, Hospira's CEO, Chris Begley, and the district court made a series of factual findings on all the key issues in this case, including finding that our witnesses were truthful in describing their motivations for each of the challenged decisions, and that the plaintiffs failed to present any credible evidence that there was any wrongful conduct. All of those factual findings, of course, are subject to reversal only based on clear error, a standard that the plaintiffs largely ignore, mentioning only in passing in their briefs, which proceed to argue the facts as if there had not been a trial and as if there had not been factual findings refuting most of the arguments in their briefs. We support multiple independent reasons for affirmance in our briefs, and I just want to highlight on each of the three claims a few points. First, the original claim and the main focus of the entire trial was that the spinoff decision itself was an ERISA violation. Well, on appeal, the only argument that we've heard is this argument about the proper causation standard, but-for causation or mixed motive causation. But based on the district court's factual findings, that legal issue, and I admit that one is a legal issue, but based on the district court's factual findings, that legal issue is irrelevant because the district court specifically found, as a factual matter, that employee benefits did not play any role in the decision to spin off this division. It found it was not benefits, employee benefits were not among the factors considered in the spin decision. So therefore, the legal issue over causation does not matter. But in any event, the district court did get it right. Gross, Supreme Court decision, series of decisions from this case, they all say the same thing. But for causation applies, unless the statute specifically says otherwise, and here the statute does not specifically say otherwise. It uses traditional but for language. Because, for the purpose of, all terms that this court and other courts have found signified but-for causation. Second claim, this no-hire claim. This is a claim that has morphed on appeal. The new argument is that Abbott Laboratories engaged in age discrimination, sort of pseudo-age discrimination, by declining to make an exception, to the now unchallenged no-hire policy. But that is the opposite of discrimination. All these folks, these retiree-eligible folks, they were treated the same as everybody else. Anybody who left Abbott after the spin announcement for any reason, whether they quit, whether they were fired, whether they retired, they wouldn't get rehired by Hospira. So there can't be discrimination if the decision is everybody's going to be treated the same, and that's exactly what happened. But moreover, the district court made specific factual findings that have been unchallenged on appeal. Nobody's arguing that they're clear error, but specific factual findings which preclude the conclusion that the decision not to make this exception for retiree-eligible folks was for the purpose of interfering with benefits. Number one, what the district court found was that Abbott Laboratories, with the advice of one of the leading benefits companies in the world, benefits consulting companies in the world, Hewitt, reached the conclusion that, you know what, we can't make an exception for retiree-eligible folks and allow them to retire from Abbott, keep the same job, and continue on at Hospira because of the IRS same-desk rule. That was the conclusion that Abbott reached, that Hewitt, a benefits consulting company, gave that advice to Abbott, and the district court made a factual finding. Paragraphs 127 and 147 of his opinion, he said the Judge Gettleman found that that alone was a reason for Abbott Laboratories not adopting this exception that plaintiffs have proposed, and it's a factual finding not challenged for clear error, so that leads to affirmance. Second point. The district court also found that, with, again, Hewitt's advice, Abbott determined that creating this exception that plaintiffs have proposed would lead to turnover problems. It's not some unlawful stereotype, as plaintiffs paint it. It's literally, hey, if somebody's drawing a pension and a salary at the same time, maybe they're less likely to stay at the company. So there were concerns about turnover. These folks were making more money. Maybe they don't need to keep a job with a salary. And avoiding turnover is a classic legitimate business justification. It is hardly an ERISA violation. And again, that was a factual finding by the district court, subject to review for clear error, and you did not hear an argument from the plaintiffs that that finding was clear error. That's page 95 of the district court's opinion. Finally, on this breach of fiduciary duty claim. And again, this claim fails for multiple independent reasons. But first, the district court found quite specifically, in response to Your Honor's questions from earlier, the district court found quite specifically that Abbott Laboratories was truthful and accurate in all its representations to its employees about Hospira's future plan. That's page 96 of the opinion.
What about this theory that there was a sin of omission?
Yeah, this is one of the problems with trying to re-argue the evidence on appeal, because that's what he was doing. What the district court did find is not only was Abbott entirely straightforward in terms of whether they were omitting something, they told the employees, you know what, after 2004, your benefits plan might be entirely different. That was a factual finding. So they let these folks know, hey, you cannot rely on your current plan because it might change entirely in 2005, a factual finding.
How did they advise the employees of that?
On the day the spin was announced, Chris Begley, the future CEO of Hospira, held a conference call, invited all employees. And during that conference call, there's a transcript, and it's in the record, and it's a factual finding by the district court. The question was, what's our new plan going to look like? And the answer from it wasn't actually Mr. Begley, it was the future head of human resources. The plan might be entirely different. We're going to look at this from front to back, and we might do something entirely different. Two of the plaintiffs in this case, there were three named plaintiffs, two of the plaintiffs in this case admitted that was information that they received and understood quite well. And in October of 2003, the spin was in April of 2004, Mr. Begley sends out a newsletter to everybody who's going to go to Hospira and said, we are looking at this plan from front to back. We're deciding what plan is best for the employees, and as soon as we get board approval, we'll let you know what that plan is, and that's exactly what happened. And in the end, the plan that was adopted was a great plan. One of the things that Abbott was advised by Hewitt was, look, you can't piecemeal the information out, because you're going to end up misleading the employees. And that was critically important here, because while it is true that Hospira decided, you know what, we're not going to continue to offer a pension, they offset that decision by increasing their 401k plan. It's an alternative way to provide for retirement benefits for employees. And the decision on increasing the 401k plan, 80% better than Abbott's. It's an amazing plan. 80% better than Abbott's. That decision undisputedly occurred after the spin. So there was no rational reason to start piecemealing information to the employees as these decisions were being made, because the result would have been misleading the employees. But aside from that, and again, these are factual findings from the trial court, two other factual findings independently lead to affirmance on the breach of fiduciary duty. The first is the court found as a factual matter. This isn't a legal matter. The court found as a factual matter that Abbott did not have any fiduciary duty over Hospira's 2005 plan because it didn't have any control over that plan. That's a factual finding by the district court, that Abbott didn't control Hospira's 2004 plan. Given that fact, adjudged by Judge Gettleman, that alone leads to affirmance. There is a second factual finding which by itself leads to affirmance on the breach of fiduciary duty, and it's this. The district court went through in detail what was happening internally before the spin occurred. And what was happening internally before the spin occurred was planning for a new 2005 plan. And this planning occurred largely in the spring of 2004. It's all in the opinion. When you are creating a new plan under this court's decision in Beach, many other decisions, when you are creating a new plan, you have no fiduciary duty. And the district court found in its factual findings that only planning for a new plan was occurring before the spin itself. And it makes sense, right? you can't have a fiduciary duty when you're in the process of creating a plan, because otherwise you'd have a fiduciary duty to maximize benefits. And, of course, the Supreme Court and common sense tells you that's not the case. Here, all that was occurring was the creation of a new plan. Fiduciary duty does not kick in at that stage, and therefore Hospira's 2005 plan was not something that Abbott Laboratories had a fiduciary duty over. In any event, all these employees get 6 months advance notice of that 2005 plan. That was more than sufficient, as Judge Gettleman held. In the end, this is not an appeal that is subject to reversal for the simple reason that Judge Gettleman did exactly what he was supposed to do. He looked at all the evidence, he heard from all the witnesses, and he entered extensive factual findings precluding the claims that are being pursued here on appeal. If there are no further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst.
Good morning. Christopher Maloney on behalf of Hospira, Inc. Your Honors, I'll be very brief today. I believe Judge Sykes was correct when she pointed out that ERISA has nothing to do with hiring. With respect to the one claim that was asserted by the plaintiffs against Hospira in this case, the beef that the plaintiffs had or the claim that they had was that Hospira refused to hire them and that somehow that violated ERISA. Not only wasn't that a violation of ERISA, but there was no discrimination here. As Mr. Hurst pointed out, this policy applied to all employees. In the trial, we pointed out that what the plaintiffs wanted to do was to convert this no-hire policy into a no-retire policy. And they were unsuccessful in the trial court, as Judge Gettleman found, and now on appeal they were trying to re-argue the evidence to once again transform a policy that applied to all employees equally into a no-retire policy, which this was not. With respect to the claim against Hospira, there are three points that I would want to make that I'd like to point out to your honors this morning. This case makes no sense as it concerns Hospira, and that's essentially what Judge Gettleman found after giving the plaintiffs every opportunity to present their claims. It makes no sense for three primary reasons. One, the claim here is based on a no-hire policy that was decided by Abbott Labs before Hospira even came into existence. As Mr. McAllister said over and over again this morning, this transaction, this spinoff, was not an arm's-length transaction. It was controlled by Abbott. It was orchestrated by Abbott. Those are his words. In essence, what they're trying to do is to pin liability on Hospira for a policy that was conceived of and written before Hospira ever existed. And that's what the trial court found, that Hospira did not exist until at the earliest April 30th of 2004. Second, plaintiffs today were on a scheme, and in their briefs they talk about a conspiracy between Abbott and Hospira. That also makes no sense. There cannot be a conspiracy here, either legally or factually. Legally, a parent company cannot conspire with its division or subsidiary. That's well established in Copperweld and all the cases that follow Copperweld. But factually, the conspiracy theory makes no sense because Abbott was the one who controlled all of the decisions here, all the decisions which the court found were implemented for legitimate business reasons. As Abbott controlled all of the decision-making here, it just makes no sense that Abbott would need to or would want to conspire with Hospira to do anything. Finally, Your Honors, in their briefs, the plaintiffs focus on this claim of discrimination. But as we said this morning, this policy applied to all employees equally. But what they ignore is the second prong of Section 510, which requires that whatever the discrimination, that it be undertaken for the purpose of interfering with the plaintiff's benefits. And here, not only have they not argued that this was done for the purpose of interfering with anybody's benefits, but as Judge Gettleman found, there was no such evidence. There was no credible evidence that either of the defendants discriminated against the plaintiff classes for the purpose of interfering with their attainment of benefits. That's at paragraph 1 on page 93 of the court's opinion. The court, after giving them 9 days to present all of the evidence that they wanted, also found that they were unable to convince the district court that the court made these, that the defendants made any of these decisions as part of a plan to deny employee benefits. There was no plan. There was no plan to deny anybody benefits of anything. In fact, again, that claim as to Hospira makes zero sense. Hospira, these weren't Hospira benefits. Hospira wasn't obligated to pay any employee benefits while they were Abbott employees. The only thing that happened was, as a result of their not retiring, the plan assets and liabilities for those employees were transferred to Hospira, and Hospira became responsible for those benefits and any shortfalls in those benefits. And that's what the evidence was during the trial, that Hospira assumed an $163 million pension liability as a result of the no-hire policy. In summary, I think Judge Sykes had it best, that what the plaintiffs are advocating for in this case is a windfall, something that no other employee gets, which is access to your benefits and at the same time being secure in your job. Nobody gets that. If you want to retire, you retire. And every plaintiff or every member of the subclass always had the ability to retire, and they still have that ability today. What they couldn't do is be assured of future employment at the spinoff entity and also access their benefits. That's what's called a windfall. That's what Judge Sykes identified as double dipping. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask that the court affirm the district court's findings on count 3 of the complaint as it's asserted against Hospira. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Corey. Gallister, how much time? 3 minutes, Mr.
Your Honors, I'd like to emphasize, first of all, that I think in spite of the defendant's protest at times, really there are three legal questions here in front of the court. Whether this anti-retiree or anti-pension recipient motive is a violation of Section 510. Again, the district court found there was such a motive. They acknowledged they had such a motive. That's a legal question. The second legal question is the standard of causation or specific intent, in our view, the gross question. And the third legal question is whether a fiduciary duty exists at all. Not the breach, but whether there's a duty is a legal question. So those three legal questions are in front of the court. Defendants claim there's no way this policy could have been Abbott's responsibility. It had to be Hospira after Hospira was formed. But again, the evidence shows that the executives who were going to Hospira knew all the details well before April 30th, 2004. On the breach of fiduciary duty question, as far back as early October, they were sending emails saying, we will freeze the pension plan. As early as December, they were doing calculations for themselves over what retiree medical benefits they were going to lose. That's all well before the spin takes place. So on the duty question, that's where we say the judge erred. That's the legal question. So if the district court is wrong about whether there's a fiduciary duty, then this case needs to go back on the breach questions that would flow and, of course, on any remedy questions. As far as 510 goes, again, the nature of this transaction was that the two parties or the two defendants here agreed. I mean, there was a policy of no hire. It wasn't the two separately and independently decided, we won't hire and we won't hire. There was an agreement as part of the spin that there would be no hiring of people back and forth between the two companies. There's testimony from the CEO of Hospira, Begley, that the unproductivity, the lack of motivation of these people if they had retired and came over to Hospira, that is the reason we adopted this policy. So in our view, there's evidence that would even satisfy a but-for causation requirement. There's certainly loads of evidence that it was a factor. I mean, again, the factual findings, 137 to 140 paragraphs in the district judge's findings, show it was a motive. But we think there's evidence even that it was really the motive for the no-hire policy was to preclude these people from retiring. The same desk rule, anybody who retired pre-spin, their assets were staying at Abbott. if they had then been hired, as Abbott later let people do. I think in footnote 3 of our reply brief, we give you the example of GE, a transaction a short time after where they absolutely let people retire and go to the new company. And also there was reference to the August 22nd conference call and what the employees were told at that point. Well, one of the things they were told, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. One of the things they were told was you can retire and go to the new company. That was something they were also told on that day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McAllister. And thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we'll move to the second case.